Well, good morning, church family. If you guys are newer with us, my name is Brian DeLay, and I'm just one of several pastors here at Piney Ridge Church, and we're so glad that you have joined us this morning. I've probably said it before, but I have many and varied interests. On one day, I'll be interested in one thing, and the next day, it's something completely different. It often drives my wife, Kirsten, crazy. She's sitting back there saying, uh-huh, for sure. One of my interests is true stories about survival, and I'm particularly interested in stories of sea survival. And I think one of the reasons that that sea survival is so intriguing to me is because when you are out on the vast ocean and something goes wrong, you have very few options available to you, right? You can't exactly just step out of your raft and walk away from your problems. When you are out on the ocean and something goes wrong, the sea becomes your prison in a very real way. And it doesn't take long at all for you to discover the stark reality that everything that is happening to you is beyond your control. You can't control the heat of the sun. You can't control the cold of the night. You can't control how strong the wind blows or how still it might be. You can't control the size of the waves or the presence of sharks or storms that might be around you. You can't control the availability of food and drinkable water. And just the immensity and power of the ocean becomes a humbling reminder that you are not in control. You can react, you can respond, but you are not in control. One of my favorite books about sea survival is a book called Adrift by Stephen Callahan. And in his book, Callahan tells the true story of him setting out to sail in a sailboat that he designed and built himself. And his plan was to sail around the Atlantic Ocean. And so he had made several legs of this journey. And his next leg was going to be from the Canary Islands, just off the coast of Africa, across the Atlantic Ocean and into the Caribbean Islands. And so 5 days into this leg of his journey, a gale sweeps in, seas begin to build, and the waves come crashing down on top of him. But for the moment, all seems to be well. That is, until during the night, while Callahan is in the bunk in his cabin, something strikes the side of his boat, and all of a sudden, water begins thundering over the top of him, which he very quickly awakens and jumps out of the boat. He jumps into a 5-foot diameter rubber survival raft with just limited supplies that he could grab on his way out. And so after surviving that first difficult night in the raft, Callahan describes how he felt the next morning. He says, "Finally, blackness yields to gray. Colors begin to blossom. Morning sun sneaks into my dungeon and brings me a glimmer of hope. I have survived the night. The coming day has never meant so much." Well, as the sun rose that morning, giving Callahan a glimmer of hope, little did he know that he would be adrift on that little 5-foot diameter rubber raft for the next 2.5 months, 76 days at sea. And so throughout his book, Callahan recounts his time in his raft, times when the sun was scorching and times when it was hidden by storm clouds, times when the air was still, and times when gale force winds would nearly capsize his raft. There were times when the ocean was calm and times when it was fierce. And then there were times when the ocean provided food and times when it left him hungry. Times when his solar stills would produce drinkable fresh water for him and times when they just didn't work. There was a certain rhythm to time and circumstance over which Steve Callahan had absolutely no control. Listen to how he describes the passing of time. He says, "An eternity exists between the click of each second. I remind myself that time does not stand still, The seconds will stack up like poker chips, seconds into minutes, minutes into hours, and hours into days. This constant rhythm of time and circumstance led to tremendous physical and emotional suffering. And Callahan struggled with whether it was worth it, whether it was worth this journey, whether it was worth it to continue each day. And each day, he would swing in his mood from moments of great hope to moments of utter despair. He says at one point, "Was it only a half a day ago that I felt so confident that I convinced myself that reality was just a small part of my life and that my imagination could give me security? Now it seems that rows of razor teeth and deep searing sores are all that there is, and I cannot escape this dismal keep even in dreams. How slim my chances really are. Perhaps I should just simply give up rather than continue this pointless struggle." This was Stephen Callahan's experience under the sun. I think one of the reasons that this story intrigues me is because so much of it paints a vivid picture of our existence under the sun, as we've been learning in Ecclesiastes. In other words, there's a reality to life as we experience it from an earthly perspective that is in this constantly changing rhythm of time and circumstance. It's like the pendulum of a clock that swings from one direction to the other, from one season to another, in a way that is fixed, and in a way that is completely beyond our control. And for what? For what? What is the point? What is the purpose in all of this? Church, the way that we answer that question, the way that we answer that question will either lead us to the darkest of despair or to the most brilliant hope. The way that we answer that question of what is the point of this life under the sun, what is the point of enduring and reacting to this constantly changing pendulum of time and circumstances, the answer to that question will either lead us to the darkest despair or to the most brilliant hope. And so today, I want to help you answer that question. I want to help you answer that question in a way that you can look to the hours and the days and the weeks and the years ahead with brilliant hope and not in dark despair. So I want to invite you to open your Bibles, if you have them, to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Jason read this passage earlier, so I'm not going to read it again. If you don't have Bibles, these scriptures that I'll be reading from today will be on the screens. So beginning in verse 1, the preacher, or Solomon, begins by making this very bold statement about time and circumstance. Look at what he says. He says, "For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." That word season in the Hebrew occurs only three other times in Scripture, and in every case it means an appointed time, a predetermined time at which some event will occur. And so Solomon is saying that every season, every time, every circumstance has been appointed, predetermined, preordained by something that is beyond us, something that completely transcends us. Whoa. That's a bold statement. That's a humbling statement. And then look in verse 2. Beginning in verse 2, the preacher then writes this amazing poem for us to illustrate what he means by this bold statement. He summarizes for us the seasons of life, what we do in time. He summarizes the whole range of human activity that occurs between our birth and our death. It's sort of like a photo album, right? Where each page that you turn shows us some significant season that occurred in our lives. We look on this page and we say, "Oh, these were days when we mourned." And on this page, we see pictures of days that we laughed. And on this page, were days that we lost. And this page, when we were seeking. There were seasons here that we see when we spoke, and times that we were quiet. There were times in this photo album when we loved, and times when we look back and we saw that we hated. Notice the feel of this poem. The preacher uses, again, this back and forth rhythm to describe the events of life, just like the pendulum of a clock, that there's a time for this, and then it swings to a time for its opposite. And so the preacher's saying, let me help you feel the rhythm of life, how it sways back and forth between opposing experiences. Let me show you what you will experience in this life under the sun. Let me paint for you a vivid picture of how the tides of life will ebb and flow between times of pleasure and times of difficulty. This poem also shows us that time and circumstance are imposed upon man. So as much as we desire to control time and circumstances by the choices that we make, we cannot. We can only react. We can only respond. No one chooses a time to be born. Has anybody chosen the time of their birth in this room? No one chooses a time to weep or a time to mourn. No one gets to decide the path of a hurricane. No one gets to decide where the epicenter of an earthquake will be. We can only react. We can only respond, but we have no control over the time and circumstance. And so an object strikes the side of a sailboat. And a sailor is adrift in the ocean for 2.5 months. A local economy fails, and a small business owner is forced to sell her store. 2 corporations merge, and an employee and a family are required to move to another state. A young man who was once part of our church family suffers a stroke, and then his young wife lies down beside him on a hospital bed through the night as he passes away. As much as we desire to control time and circumstances by the choices that we make, we cannot. Okay, Solomon, this is heavy. So you've said that there is a predetermined time for everything. You've shown that these times and these circumstances are pervasive, that they govern everything and that we have no control. Then for what? What am I supposed to do with that? Solomon, are you just going to drop this bomb among us and walk away, leaving us to figure things out on our own? Are you not going to offer any interpretation or any comment? Are my choices and reactions to the events that occur in my life, between my birth and my death, really that meaningless? Where is the hope in that? I think Solomon wrestled with these questions as well. Look at verse 9. He asked, what gain has the worker from his toil? That word toil here is not just limited to our job. It really encompasses all that we must do in this life under the sun. And so if all the times and seasons and events of life are outside of our control, if our lives are consumed by continuously reacting to the pendulum of time and circumstance, if this toil is our earthly reality, then what gain is there? What is the purpose in it? Is there any pursuit that is meaningful or constructive? It's at this point in the passage that Solomon shifts the lens from the stark earthly reality that we experience, and he shifts it to a heavenly perspective. Look at verse 9. Solomon says, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Remember back in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says that from our earthly perspective, he says it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. That's our earthly perspective, that this is an unhappy business. But now in these verses, he gives us a glimpse of God's perspective. He shifts the focus from this earthly reality that we experience to an eternal reality, showing that God is sovereignly and providentially ordering the events of our life with purpose and with beauty. Think of it like this. From our earthly vantage point, we see the events of life like the underside of a tapestry being woven on a loom. The underside of a tapestry being woven on the loom, you look and you see that the threads are in no meaningful pattern. They look chaotic. There are snarls and knots, and nothing seems to make sense. There's really not much beauty on the underside of a tapestry as it's being woven. But here in verse 10, Solomon turns the loom for us, giving us a glimpse of the other side as God views it from his perspective. We get a glimpse from God's perspective of incredible beauty, where all of the threads have been woven together, perfectly arranged by God into a beautiful, colorful tapestry. So far from leading us to utter despair, for those of us who have faith in God, the times that he has established for us can be a source of great hope and great joy, knowing that he is making something beautiful of our lives. But we long to see more than just a glimpse of this beauty, right? We long to see the fullness of the tapestry that he's weaving. We want to see this beauty now, but it seems like God has hidden it from us. We just can't make sense of things. We desire it, but we just can't see it. Why does it seem like it's hidden from us? Look at verse 11. The preacher says, also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. All of us have the capacity for eternal things. We're concerned about the past, right? What were the things that brought us to this point in our lives? And then we're concerned about the future and what life is going to be like in this life and then life after death. We all sense that there's something that transcends us, something that is better, something that is more beautiful than this life under the sun. And we long for it. We long to see it. We long to be a part of it. Even for those who say that they don't believe in God, this is true of them as well. Listen to what Steve Callahan said while he was drifting in his raft. He said, I wonder about God. Do I believe in him? Somehow I cannot accept a vision of a superhumanoid. But I believe in the miraculous and spiritual way of things, existence, nature, the universe. I do not know the true workings of that way. I can only guess and hope that it includes me. Just like Callahan, every human being who has ever walked the face of the earth, God has placed eternity in our hearts. And yet we will discover that there is nothing on this planet that can fulfill that longing. There is nothing. Only God himself can fulfill it. Right now, it's like we're looking at a mirror dimly. But the scripture says, one day we will see fully. One day we will see him face to face. Verse 11 goes on to say that God has put eternity in our hearts, but he's done it in such a way that God's ordering of things has been hidden from us. What did Jesus tell his disciples when they asked him after his resurrection if he would now restore the kingdom to Israel? He told them in Acts 1:7, "It is not for you to know the times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority." It is not for you to know the times or the seasons. God, the Creator, who providentially governs and sustains all things, has hidden from us his times and his purposes. Sometimes we get a glimpse. Sometimes we can look back over the months and the years of our lives and we can see evidence of how God has ordered things, bringing us to this point, and we can see the result of that. We can see beauty, but it's only a glimpse, and it is rare. And so trying to understand how God has ordered things in our lives, trying to make sense of it, is a futile effort. Listen to what J.I. Packer says about this. He says, "The harder you try to understand the divine purpose in the ordinary providential course of events, the more obsessed and oppressed you grow with the apparent aimlessness of everything. And the more you are tempted to conclude that life really is as pointless as it looks." But we say to God, "God, wouldn't it be better if you would just show me what you're doing? Wouldn't it be better if you would help me to make sense of all of this? Wouldn't I have joy in seeing that? Wouldn't I have more contentment? Wouldn't it be better for you to show me what you're doing so that I can trust you more?" How does Solomon answer these questions? In verse 12, he says, "I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that every man should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to man." There is nothing better for us to do than to be joyful, to do good as long as we live, to eat and drink, to be content, to take pleasure in this toil, because it is a gift from God. When we give up on this futile effort to try to understand God's ways or to try to control or manipulate what he has ordained, when we place our trust in him to orchestrate all that happens in our lives, it's only then that we can find true joy. It's only then that we can find true contentment, even in the midst of the pendulum swing of time and circumstances. We can find peace by leaving the results of our toil to God. So whatever God has given you to do, whether it is changing diapers in this season of your life, or voting for a president, or burying a loved one, we can do it with contentment in our humanity. We can do it with contentment. Think of that. We can do it with contentment in our humanity because we trust in God's sovereignty. And here's the foundational truth in which that trust in God is rooted. Look at verse 14. "I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away." I think for some of us, when we read that passage right there, it might sound a little rigid and cold, right? Whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing taken away. He has done it so that people fear him. What has that which is already has been. And so how does embracing that truth that seems so rigid and cold lead to our joy in our toil? How can that lead to contentment in our humanity and trust in God? Bear with me for just a moment as I try to unpack the answer to that question. We think about Ecclesiastes and what we've been studying, and we know that the message of Ecclesiastes is that nothing we do on our own has any permanence. Everything we do will waste away. Everything that we do will be forgotten. Everything is vanity. Everything is a vapor in the wind. It is meaningless. Nothing we do, whether it is raising our children or winning the World Series, will even be a footnote in history. I'm sorry, Cubs fans. But here in verses 14 and 15, we see how embracing this truth of God's absolute sovereignty can lead to joy and contentment, because whatever God does, does endure forever. He has purpose in all that he does. Everything that he does is secure. It will come to pass. And so out of his great love for us, he takes the snarled, knotted, chaotic, meaningless threads of our lives, and he weaves a tapestry out of it that is forever beautiful, that endures. In other words, it's God's meaningful, beautiful, eternal work in and through us that actually gives our work eternal meaning and beauty. And this is why this seemingly rigid and cold verse can actually produce in us joy and contentment in our toil, because we can rest in his sovereignty. The most beautiful example of this was on a day over 2,000 years ago when a man named Jesus was falsely accused, when he was convicted and murdered. You think about that season from his followers' earthly perspective under the sun. You can imagine them asking, what good and eternal thing could possibly come from this? What good could come from our friend being murdered? Remember back in our Transform series, we preached on Luke chapter 24, where we read that after Jesus was crucified, two of his friends were walking down this road toward Emmaus, and they were talking about how they had hoped that Jesus was the one who would redeem Israel. But now, he was murdered. There are these rumors about his body missing and people seeing him, and they're confused and they're bewildered. In that moment, they could only see the ugly underside of the tapestry. But then what happened? Jesus walks up beside them, and he turns the loom, and they get a glimpse of God's beautiful plan and his perfect timing, not just simply to redeem Israel as a nation as they had hoped, but to redeem all throughout history. From every tribe and tongue and nation, those who would put their faith in him. His timing and his plans were so much grander, so much greater, so much more loving than these two men could possibly imagine. And it was all in God's perfect, beautiful timing. Paul says in Galatians 4:4, in the fullness of time, at just the right time, God sent forth his Son so that we might receive adoption as sons. Then earlier in Romans 5:6, Paul says, for while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Church, we see in the face of Jesus Christ the ultimate example of how God takes the ugly and he makes all things beautiful in their time. So, what is our response this morning? What's our response? I think there are two ways that we often respond to God as we experience and as we react to this constantly changing rhythm of time and circumstance. And the first is arrogance. For example, suppose we were the ones who survived being adrift for 2.5 months in a small raft. I think if we're honest with ourselves, many of us would be tempted to say that it was because of our own wisdom and knowledge and skill that we were carried over 1,800 miles to safety. After all, we were the ones who were smart enough to carry a raft in our boat, right? We were the ones who kept the solar stills working to provide water. We were the ones who speared fish to eat. We were the ones who made a sextant out of 2 pencils to navigate by the stars. Were we not the ones who overcame what time and circumstance dished out on us? As William Henley says in his poem, were we not the masters of our fate and the captains of our souls? If that's your response to God and his sovereignty over time and circumstance, if your response is arrogance, let me ask you this. And you can relate this to the circumstances of your own life. As you applied your wisdom and knowledge and skill, who was the one who created you in his image with that capacity? As you drifted on the waves and the swells towards safety, who was the one who spoke that ocean into existence? As you kept your solar stills working to provide you with fresh water, who was it that parted the clouds so that the sun would shine down, causing condensation so that you could drink? As you caught fish that traveled alongside your raft for the entire journey, who was the one who caused the ocean to teem with fish and ordained that they gather around your raft? And as you navigated by the stars, who was the one who flung those innumerable galaxies into the universe with a word? Creation itself should humble us and send us to our knees in worship. Often our arrogance, though, is not so obvious. Often we disguise our arrogance by calling it wisdom, by calling it godly wisdom. We somehow think that godly wisdom means that we have some special insight into his ways, and we presume what God will do in our future. And then we take comfort in that. We make decisions because we believe more in our presumptions about God's will, what he's going to do in our future. And then something happens, and it completely shatters our illusion. And then we respond with anger toward God. Our pride gets hurt. And then instead of kneeling before him in worship, we pout before God. If your response to God's sovereignty over time and circumstance is arrogance, listen to what God says in Isaiah 46. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish my purpose. Those words should crush our arrogance before God. A second common response to God's sovereignty is anxiety, apprehension. While Callahan was adrift in his raft, he said, "Worry, worry, worry. It is apprehension that beds with me each night, and apprehension that awakens me each day. As darkness comes and I drift off to sleep, I long to be in a place with no anxieties." When Callahan came to the stark realization that his time and circumstance were beyond his control, there was no rest for him. There was only constant apprehension. Would the next shark attack end his journey? Would it end his life? Would the solar stills fail to provide water? What would happen if his sun-cracked raft deflated right in the middle of the ocean? It would be over. How many of us, like Stephen Callahan, live in a near constant state of anxiety, apprehension over what life might bring next. For some of us, maybe it's not a constant state of anxiety. Maybe for some of us, our joy and contentment are simply just slaves to that ever-changing pendulum of time and circumstance. We're like Callahan, who says, "My mood follows the sun. The light of each day makes me optimistic that I might last another 40. But the darkness of each night makes me realize, if any one thing goes wrong, I will not survive. My rapidly shifting moods chase one another until I feel completely confused." Arrogance and anxiety. And I think for most of us, our response often is to swing between those two in our responses to God. And so what is the right response to the constantly changing pendulum of time and circumstance? What is the antidote to our arrogance and our anxiety? Look with me at the conclusion that Solomon comes to in verse 14. He says, "God has done it so that people fear before him." God has done it so that people fear before him. Church, the answer to the question that I posed at the beginning is this: God's absolute sovereignty over time and circumstance is meant to bring us to a sense of humble reverence and awe of him. And when we do, it's only then that we can experience this life under the sun or on our raft in great hope, in great joy, and in contentment. It is only when we bow before a holy God, when we trust in his sovereignty over our times, our seasons, our circumstances, that we can find true joy. And that is the answer to the question that brings us brilliant hope for the future. I'm going to invite the band to come forward at this time. As we prepare to respond in worship before this sovereign and holy God, I want these words from Isaiah 45 to sink deeply into your soul. God says, "I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I equip you, though you do not know me, that the people may know from the rising of the sun to the west that there is none besides me. I am the Lord and there is no other. I form light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things." For those whose response to this kind of God is rebellion, there is only utter despair for you in this life and in the life to come. But for those who fear God by putting their faith and trust in Jesus Christ, whether a spouse dies young or a presidential election disappoints, no matter what has passed or what lies before us, we can live in brilliant hope. I want to invite you guys to stand. And may our response today be to worship him.